Hey, everybody. Welcome to LRS First Thursday, the monthly podcast from Labor Relations Information System. My name is Rick Polson. I'm the executive director of LRIS, and welcome back, everybody. Thanks for being with us. Before we get into today's cases, just wanted to make a quick note about a couple of upcoming LRS seminars this spring and early summer. In April, we'll be in Nashville for our collective bargaining seminar. That's a great seminar. It's built around what public safety bargaining actually looks like right now, right? Staffing shortages, wage compression, comparability issues, political pressure, all of the things that folks are dealing with on the union side and the management side at the table. We're going to spend a lot of time on strategy, on what happens at the table, and on comparability. So it's for union leaders, staff reps, lawyers, management folks who are actively involved in negotiations. If you're interested in that, check it out at www.lrs.com/seminars. And for our law enforcement folks in June, we're going to be back in Las Vegas for our Rights of Police Officers seminar. That's a great seminar. We focus on all of the day-to-day issues that law enforcement, labor relations folks deal with constantly, and that's discipline and due process, speech and privacy issues, lots of privacy issues this year, body cams, you know, all of that stuff. The law is rapidly changing in those areas. And we spent 2.5 days in Vegas in June talking about it. Again, lrs.com/seminars. One other note, I've been posting short labor law related kind of Q&A videos on TikTok. So quick answers to real questions that we get from union reps and lawyers. There's no gimmicks or anything like that. There's no dancing. But if you're on TikTok, check me out at rick.p67. Okay, let's get into the cases. So there's a clear theme running through all four of our cases this month. The cases, by the way, I pulled every one of them. I normally don't, but I pulled every one of them from the Public Safety Labor News newsletter that we do monthly. If you don't subscribe to that, check it out, lrs.com. Yeah, if you're interested in subscribing. If not, I'm going to tell you about four of the cases. And I picked each of the cases because, you know, something similar happens in each one of them. And in every case, the employer or the agency attempts to win the dispute by narrowing the issue, right? By leaning on technical definitions or labels or procedural arguments. And there's nothing wrong with that, by the way, but it's a common tactic, and we see this in all four of the cases. And basically, the move is that, you know, the employer attempts to define the right narrowly, right, or to relabel the problem so that the protection, you know, seems not to apply, you know, in that case. And then once you've established that way, you try to win on that technical boundary rather than on the underlying fairness or the merits of the argument that the employee or the union is making in those cases. Again, this is a pretty common tactic that we see employers do, and there's nothing wrong with it necessarily, right? If we're an adversarial proceeding, you do what you need to do to win. So it's like, let me define it, put a fence around it, kill it, right? And whether the outcome is fair or unfair, you know, in general terms, doesn't really matter, right? It's you know, did we win this particular dispute? In each of the four cases, the court rejects those types of positions. The court pushes back and basically says, look, nice try. We're not going to let formal labels defeat what the statute or the protection, you know, is actually for in each of those cases. You know, and sometimes we see that, sometimes we don't. But we have four cases from, you know, different states with different facts. The same instinct by the employer to kind of catch and kill, and the same judicial response to reject that attempt. And so maybe you'll see the theme. I'm going to talk about all four of them, and let's see where it takes us. Case number one is a fun one. It comes out of my home state of Pennsylvania, although it's over on the west side of Pennsylvania, the city of Pittsburgh. And the case is FOP Fort Pitt Lodge number 1 versus City of Pittsburgh. It's a decision of Pennsylvania's State Labor Board, and specifically a hearing officer of the State Labor Board. And it was issued in December of 2025. And so, you know, the facts of the case are pretty fun. They start in familiar territory, and that's a grievance arbitration proceeding. And so we have an officer, his last name's in the case, but we're just going to, the first letter's T. So we're going to call him Officer T. Officer T is a Pittsburgh police officer. He's not under investigation. He's not accused of misconduct or anything like that. He's been subpoenaed by the FOP to act as a union witness in a particular arbitration. And so we have an officer subpoenaed by the FOP in advance of a hearing. What does the city do in response to that? Before the arbitration hearing, the city sends a notice to the city solicitor's office, sends a notice to that officer to report to the solicitor's office so that the solicitor can interview Officer T about what it is he's going to say in the arbitration hearing. Officer T gets a little concerned, right? He's been called to the carpet to participate in an interview about some matter of dispute between the union and the city. And he says, I want to have a union representative present here. And the city solicitor tells him, nope, this isn't a Weingarten situation. You're not entitled to a union representative. You're not the target of any type of discipline in regard to this case. You have to sit for an interview. And in fact, if you refuse to sit for this interview, if you refuse to talk to me, then that refusal in and of itself is going to be considered insubordination. And then you're going to have a discipline problem. So the message in that case was pretty clear that you either cooperate with us or you face discipline. What did the union do in response? The union filed an unfair practice charge. The union alleged a Weingarten violation, but beyond that, they alleged that the city's actions with respect to Officer T were coercive with respect to Officer T's right to engage in union activity, and essentially that the city was retaliating in some way against Officer T for just being a witness, right, in an arbitration between the parties. After the union filed the charge, by the way, the city backed off, and the city allowed an interview, and they allowed the FOP president to sit in on the interview with Officer T. But by that point, they had already kind of made the threat. And the FOP president, actually Bob Schwartzwelder, give Bob a shout out. He's a great FOP president. He fights for his folks. And I could see Bob getting ticked off by what the solicitor's office did and then making sure that he sat in on the interview when it ultimately happened. So they do the witness interview. Nothing particularly eventful happens there. But the union proceeds with the ULP charge. On what happened the first time the officer came in and was forced to answer questions. And they conduct the charge. Hearing officer hears the party's arguments and issues a decision at the end of 2025. And, the city's argument was what you might think. They said, Weingarten rights don't apply unless an employee reasonably fears discipline based on questioning about their own conduct. In this instance, Officer T was only a witness. He wasn't being interrogated about his own wrongdoing. Therefore, no Weingarten violation would occur. And just because Officer T could be disciplined if he refused to sit for that interview by being insubordinate, that doesn't, rise to the level of triggering Weingarten protections. And so the city didn't violate the law by refusing to grant his request to have a union representative present. The hearing examiner agreed with the city's position. And I think rightly so, that if we apply formal Weingarten standards to this case, there wasn't a violation. Officer T wasn't the target of discipline. Weingarten rights generally are going to apply when the employee has a reasonable belief, an objectively reasonable belief. Find an objectively reasonable person, by the way, and let me know who they are so I can write them a love letter, because they don't exist. But, if somebody reasonably believes that they could be disciplined as a result of the conduct that they're being asked about, then generally they're going to have the right to have a union representative sit with them as their witness during an investigatory interview. And the union rep is supposed to be able to help, kind of serve as a traffic cop, make sure questions are asked and people have an opportunity to answer and all that good stuff. 99% of the time, the employer knows the drill, the employee knows the drill, and the interviews go off without any issues. That 1% of the time, there were the cases that we wind up talking about. And so the union alleges a Weingarten violation. The city says, wasn't one. The hearing examiner agrees with them. Case over? No, case isn't over. And that's what makes this case interesting. The hearing officer correctly noted that Pennsylvania said labor law separately prohibits employers from coercing or interfering with protected activity, right? And you can do that in a number of ways. Serving as a union witness in an arbitration is protected activity. Whether you're doing that voluntarily or whether that you're doing that in this case, pursuant to subpoena, as Officer T was. But, that action as a witness in a grievance arbitration is protected activity. And by threatening discipline, right, especially invoking insubordination in a paramilitary organization, by threatening discipline in connection with that role, the city acted in a way that, according to the labor board or the hearing examiner, was inherently coercive. And so, what the hearing examiner in that particular case recognized is that, even where the employer was technically correct about the Weingarten position, right, that you're not entitled to a union rep, but by taking someone and forcing them to sit for an interview, under threat of discipline, under those circumstances, that conduct had a tendency to coerce Officer T with respect to his exercise of union rights. So the labor board did find a violation of the law with respect to that aspect of it, right? So they were right with respect to Weingarten, but the way they play their cards was inappropriate and they still got dinged. And so, that's the first example, I think, of a case where, management was technically right, with respect to how they viewed the case. But when a reviewing body, and here a hearing examiner for the state labor board, took a broader view of the conduct, they found problematic conduct here. And so conditioning participation as a union witness on submission to a management interview under threat of discipline, according to Pennsylvania's labor board, chills the grievance process. And the city of Pittsburgh violated the law by doing that. So, win a technical argument, but lose the big picture because the court takes into account the real world pressure and effect. That way of, I agree with the court's decision or the hearing examiner's proposed decision in this particular case. And you're going to see that same way of looking at things, looking at the technical argument versus the broader impact of the employer's action through the remaining three cases that we talk about. So that's case number one. Case number two comes from the state of New Hampshire. This one is called Appeal of Cass. It was decided by the state Supreme Court in December of 2025. I like this correctional officer in this case. Comes out of a correctional facility, and the officer's name is Claudia Cass. We'll call her Officer C, but now we all know her name. But she did her job, and she stood up to the bosses, and she was successful in this case. And so she's the CO. Working in a facility with an understaffing problem. I'm sure that's a shocker that we have a prison facility in the country with understaffing, right? Every facility, every public safety agency, I think, in the country seems to be understaffed in one, way or another. And New Hampshire's a statewide prison system was no different. And so she worked in a New Hampshire correctional facility and she sent emails up the chain of command to the bosses, raising concerns about low staffing levels and the safety impacts of those low staffing levels. And she pointed, in doing so, she pointed to a DOC policy that required lockdowns when staffing fell below certain minimums. And basically, she said, hey, I'm letting you know that, we're dangerously low with respect to our staffing levels, and I'm going to be complying with our rules here in the facility. And I'm going to, put folks on lockdown if we get down to X number of officers on staff. Management pushed back and said, well, you don't get to decide that. We're the bosses. We set the rules. We know what our policies are. But, you don't have the ability as a correctional officer to make a decision as to whether or not your unit is going to go on lockdown or not. We do. And Officer C, in response, said, look, I'm going to do what I think is right. And if you order me to make a decision or to take an action with respect to inmate and officer safety that I believe is unsafe, I'm not going to follow that order. And my doing so is not insubordinate. So Officer C stepped up, and for her trouble, what do you think happened? She got fired. The officer said, you don't get to make those decisions. We do. Your job is to follow orders. You heard the term obey now, grieve later. If you think it's unsafe, go file a grievance, but you don't get to just refuse what to do. So they fire Officer Cass. She challenges the termination through their kind of appellate system, their civil service-y type system there in New Hampshire. And she argued, made another number of arguments that boiled down to the order that I did not comply with was an illegal order. It was an improper order. It was an unsafe order. And it was inconsistent with the jail zone, the prison zone, internal policies, which we would imagine are put into effect in order to provide for the safety of the facility and the people that are both incarcerated in it and working in it. She argues, among other things, before the appellate review board, that her actions were protected under New Hampshire's whistleblower statute. And she also argued that her actions were actually protected speech, right? She was speaking, out on a matter of public concern, in this instance, staffing and safety in a facility. When the case reached the personnel appeal board, decided it, the board basically said, look, the employer provided a couple of general orders, basically saying you have to follow orders. You didn't follow orders. We're not going to get into your whistleblower claims. We're not going to get into your speech claims. You were fired for violating a policy, and it looks to us like you violated the policy. And so they rejected, Officer Cass's, Officer C's appeal and upheld the termination. The board didn't really explain much, didn't provide much analysis of the facts or apply the facts in Officer C's case to the policies that she was alleged to have violated. They just kind of concluded, hey, you violated the policies and therefore you're fired. It's what we would call like a pretty thin decision, which a lot of times is going to be enough actually to hold up on appeal. But we didn't have any explanation about how Officer C's actions violated the facility's policies, and the board completely refused to address the whistleblower and speech claims. Officer C appealed that determination. The case made its way up to New Hampshire Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court sided with Officer C. Not completely. They remanded the case to go back to the personnel appeal board. But the big issue was the argument and the statute itself that they were operating under. And the statute that the personnel appeals board operates under, it says that the board shall, and it doesn't say may, it says shall reinstate an employee if the discipline was undertaken in violation of a statute. That was one of the reasons, right, that a disciplinary action could be overturned. And the court said, well, Officer C argued that, her termination violated the whistleblower law. And Officer C argued that her termination violated her First Amendment rights. And when the board refused to even consider those things, it did not meet its charge to determine whether or not a statute was violated. And so, essentially the Supreme Court said that the board couldn't avoid deciding whether a statute was violated in this case, and that jurisdiction wasn't optional, right? When in this particular case, reinstatement would turn on statutory compliance, where the employee made a specific allegation of a statutory violation, you're going to have to deal with and make a decision as to whether or not you think that was violated or not, right? You don't get to refuse to look at the statute. The court then, also looked at the board's reasoning just for determining the policies were violated. And the court, also just wasn't satisfied with that and said, hey, look, simply listing policies without explaining how the employer's or the employee's conduct violated them doesn't permit meaningful review on appeal, right? Courts need to see the logic behind the decision. And that process, right, matters because that's how we enforce accountability on appeal. You can't just say, you know, okay, she didn't make her case without explaining why she didn't make her case. And if you don't do that, it makes it difficult and not possible, if not impossible, for an appellate court to do its job. And so what happened? The court remanded it back to the Personnel Appeals Board and told them to do their job, right? With respect to the underlying violations, you better spell it out explain why this officer engaged in the misconduct that she was alleged of engaging in. And you also need to address her statutory arguments and explain why, I guess the board didn't even make a determination. So the court needs to determine whether, in fact, they believe the statute was violated. And so here, you know, we have another case, right, where you have a very focused, too focused view of a situation an agency tried to win, or basically an appellate board, a lower appellate board, tried to focus on what I would call procedural avoidance, right, of an issue, and taking a limited view of the case before it, as opposed to taking a broader view. And so, you know, the real takeaway from the Supreme Court, you know, was its rationale for why the board, aside from ignoring the statutory arguments, needed to provide some type of justification or explanation for its decision on the policy violations. And that's where, you know, the process stuff gets elevated, right? You know, process isn't a technicality, right? It's a mechanism that enables accountability on the back end. And so we have a reviewing court in the New Hampshire case in the context of potentially, you know, reinstating an officer in a pretty significant safety matter, saying we're not going to be overly technical. The statute matters, but there are bigger issues here in play as well. And so that's case number two, where we have the employer, or in this particular instance, the personnel board, taking a really limited view at a dispute, and a reviewing court taking a broader view in favor, at least on an interim basis, in favor of the employee. Okay, our third case comes from the state of New Jersey. And you'll note that our cases are all kind of mid-Atlantic-y, northeast-y this month. We've got Pennsylvania, New Hampshire, New Jersey, and then we've got a Massachusetts case that comes up next, just kind of way the cookie crumbled this month. This one involves the city of Jersey City. It's called State's Newsroom versus City of Jersey City. And it was decided late last year. And it's an interesting case because it involves criminal charges and an expungement. And how does that relate to public records requests as a concurrent investigation? So all of the stuff that we deal with a lot, you know, come up in this case. And so what happened in this particular case was a Jersey City police lieutenant was involved in an off-duty incident in August of 2019. Not a great incident. The lieutenant allegedly was drinking, gets into a heated argument with his girlfriend over food. There's an allegation that at some point the lieutenant says, the quote is, "Today is your day." He gets a shotgun right out of the safe. Fired around in somebody's direction. Nobody was hit. One of the witnesses alleged that the lieutenant stated, "It's time to die." Not sure, if that was accurate or not, but it's certainly part of the record. So not great facts. State police respond to the scene. They arrest the lieutenant. They charge him with terroristic threats, possession of a weapon for an unlawful purpose, you know, all of that stuff. Okay. The case, the criminal case gets litigated. And by the spring of 2020, the lieutenant essentially achieved a successful resolution to that case and was permitted to plead to a lesser charge. And he enrolled in a pretrial intervention program. And the outcome of that program would be that if you successfully complete it, the record is expunged. And that's fantastic, right? Those programs are excellent. Now, separate from the criminal proceeding, the police department opened its own internal affairs investigation, right? These are serious allegations. And this is the kind of stuff we deal with all the time, a concurrent investigation with, we have a criminal investigation, we have the police department's internal investigation. You know, what do we do with respect to the officer's interviews? Can he be called in to an interview? We talk about Garrity cases all the time. This isn't a Garrity case. You know, if you want to know about that stuff, come to our discipline seminar in November. We're going to be in Nashville. We're going to spend 3 days about discipline, procedural stuff, Garrity, all that. That's usually a really fun one. We don't have a Garrity issue in this case. We just have, we have the internal, it's conducted. At the end of the process, the department concluded that the lieutenant violated different policies and procedures of the police department, and they gave him a 90-day suspension. Okay, so we have criminal investigation ends in a pretrial intervention program, no conviction, right? And we have an internal investigation that results in a 90-day suspension. Now, fast forward a little bit. In early 2022, the Jersey Supreme Court decided a case involving the state's Open Records Act. And part of that decision, or the outcome of that decision, was that internal affairs reports could, in fact, be disclosed under Jersey's public records law. A couple of days after that case was decided, this particular news organization, State's Newsroom, it's you might know it as the New Jersey Monitor if you're in that part of the country, requested this specific IA report. So they go, oh, we have this allegation of this officer firing a shotgun. We know we got a 90-day suspension. We want a copy of the entire internal affairs report. Now, interestingly enough, the city denied the request. A lot of times what we see in these cases is the city doesn't do that, right? So you'll have somebody request an internal affairs report. Usually the press will you know, request an internal affairs report. The employer a lot of times says, yeah, sure, why not? And you know, maybe they're not that cavalier, but it's not always profiles and courage, right? The employer says, sure, they're ready to turn it over. And it's the officer or it's the union that attempts, that initiates a legal action preventing the release of the information. And you'll have an argument over what needs to be released or not. But usually it's the officer, not always, but usually it's the officer or the union that are making that argument. And so credit to Jersey City, to the police department for determining that it was not appropriate to release the internal affairs report. Now, the main reason that the city identified to support its decision not to release the information was that the criminal case, the criminal allegations were expunged, and that the expungement order regarding the allegations, which it's the same set of facts, right? You know, there are allegations concerning an incident that resulted in a termination, or I'm sorry, a 90-day suspension. The police department said that we have an expungement order categorically barring the release of any information related, right, to this particular incident. And so because that was in effect, essentially releasing the internal affairs report would cause the city to violate the expungement order. That was the gist of the city's argument. The newspapers appeal, the case makes its way up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court of New Jersey disagreed. And the court reasoned that the internal affairs report was not a criminal record, right? The expungement order only applied to criminal records. They're different proceedings. And in this particular instance, an internal affairs report isn't a criminal record. It's an administrative record concerning violations of the department's rules and regulations. You know, it's not a record of a criminal disposition. The court was, I think, right with that. The court basically then said that the expungement statute and the expungement order then didn't bar the release of every page of the internal affairs report. The court did note that there could be information within the report that could directly reveal the expunged arrest or the criminal charges or the conviction or the disposition. And to the extent that the internal affairs report might contain information that was prohibited from release by the expungement order, that what would have to happen would be redaction. The court ordered exactly that. And the court actually ordered a pretty detailed process. The matter was remanded to lower court for an in-camera review, and it's going to be a private review where the judge can go through the proposed release and determine whether any information in the internal affairs report overlapped, right, with the criminal proceeding. And once those redactions were made, right, then at that point, we could take a look at any of the remainder there, right? Because the police department, the government still has the ability to determine that certain information is confidential and certain information doesn't need to be released. And there's a balancing test that courts are going to require with respect to that. And so the court said here, though, just because there is an expungement, you don't just get to say that's a concrete wall and we don't have to release anything. Yeah, the court said, no, let's go through this in a thoughtful manner. Let's have in-camera review. Let's redact and remove information that might be covered by the expungement order. And let's say that's 30% of the internal affairs report. And for the remaining 70%, now we're going to have to apply the balancing test. And so that's what the court ordered to happen in that particular case. And, you know, it's another situation, right, where it's not as simple as just putting a label on something and saying, oh, this request, this is going to cause us to violate an expungement order. That's it. You know, done. We don't have to think about this anymore. No, the court said that, you know, rights don't disappear, right, when you wave a magic wand. In some instances, it may be more difficult. We may have to go through more of a process to make sure that the employer, or in this instance, the government, is meeting its obligations. And so, you know, another instance where an employer, you know, attempts to kind of take the, I don't want to say the easy way out, but the shorter route, you know, to the finish line, and a reviewing court says it's not that simple. Our fourth case comes from the state of Massachusetts. It's a firefighter case. It's called Driscoll versus City of Melrose. It was decided at the end of 2025 by Massachusetts Court of Appeals. And this is a military leave case. So it involves a firefighter who serves in the Air National Guard and is entitled, therefore, to military leave in this particular instance under Massachusetts state law. You know, what makes these things interesting and what makes lots of issues that have us look at a firefighter schedule interesting, like wage and hour cases, is that firefighters don't work a Monday through Friday 9-to-5 schedule. Well, I mean, shoot, nobody in public safety land works a 9-to-5 schedule. But, you know, we do see more 8-hour shifts or 10-hour shifts or, you know, a lot of 12-hour shifts in law enforcement and in corrections. We don't see them as much in fire. You know, in fire, you know, we're going to tend to see shorter shifts. Maybe we'll see 12s, but there's a lot of 24-hour shifts and even 48-hour shifts, depending on, you know, where you work. Maybe out west, there's lots of places where it's a 48. And so with the 24-hour shift come lots of interesting questions, you know, about things like, well, what is a day and how is leave to be, distributed? If you get 10 days of sick leave a year, when you work an 8-hour shift, what happens if you convert over to a 24-hour shift? And so do our 10 hours, our 10 8-hour days, which at last time I checked is 80 hours, does that now become 240 hours of sick leave because your sick day is a 24-hour day. In some instances, yeah, it is. In some instances, we prorate down or we prorate up so that the total number of hours of leave in a year, you know, don't change consequent to a change in shift length. But this is the kind of stuff that you guys know we deal with in bargaining, you know, all the time. Sometimes, though, there are external statutes that are impacted by those decisions and that we have to deal with that. And that's exactly what happened in Massachusetts. And so in this particular department in the city of Melrose, firefighters worked a 24-hour shift. For leave purposes, and specifically in the case, it says for vacation and sick leave purposes, a 24-hour period of work, a 24-hour shift was treated as two shifts, like two 12-hour shifts for vacation or two, you know, if you took a sick day, that means you took two sick days, two 12-hour sick days to cover your 24-hour work period. And like people who are civilians who are listening to this say that doesn't make any sense. And people who, you know, work in agencies like this say, yeah, that's kind of how we do it, right? You know, it's the type of arrangement that we see in public safety agencies. And so we have a firefighter working 24-hour shifts in a place where, at least for vacation and sick leave, a shift is 12 hours, not 24 hours. You already know where this is going. And so, you know, throughout this particular firefighter's employment, you know, he would miss shifts due to military training and actually from the due to active duty. And over the years in question here, he missed over 40 24-hour shifts, right, in several fiscal years. And he saw payment for those shifts. When he requested payment for those shifts, his employer took the position that he was only required to be paid for service within the first 40 consecutive calendar days of any fiscal year, and that, you know, each missed 24-hour shift that occurred outside of the first 40 consecutive days of a fiscal year were not eligible for compensation. Why did they argue that? They argued that because the statute, in effect, states that an employee who misses time for military service essentially must be provided their full pay, quote, not exceeding 40 days in any federal fiscal year. Okay, let me read that again. Not exceeding 40 days in any federal fiscal year. What's a day? Does this mean you get 40 24-hour shifts? Or does it mean that you get paid for, I don't know, however many days? Is it 40 12-hour days in a fiscal year or not? Or can you be really aggressive like the city did in this place and said that the 40 days in the state statute, what it really meant was that those days be consecutive. And so what the city said is that this particular firefighter would be entitled to pay for his military leave so long as that military was used in a 40 consecutive day period in the fiscal year, which was an interesting interpretation of the statute, which obviously would have a significant impact and did have a significant impact of the firefighter in question here. This is a pretty straightforward statutory interpretation case before the Supreme Court. And what did the court do? I mean, the court looked at the statute itself, right? And the statute itself says 40 days in any fiscal year. What does it not say? It doesn't say consecutive. You know, and the court notes that in its decision. There's no requirement in Section 59A of that particular law that the 40 days be consecutive. And the court cited other areas, right, in the statute where there is reference to consecutive days. And that's a pretty common, you know, statutory interpretation and contract interpretation trick. You know, if you said consecutive days somewhere else, right, in the contract, and you didn't say it, you know, if you say, if you use consecutive days in Article 2 of a contract, and then you have reference to days in Article 8 of a contract, and you don't say consecutive. If I'm looking at that and I'm trying to interpret that, you know, as a judge or as an arbitrator, my takeaway is that, well, when you wanted to require consecutive days, you knew how to do it, right? If it said it in Article 2, it said consecutive, you knew how to limit a benefit by using that word. And so when you didn't do it in Article 8, that tells me that whether you intended to or not, that tells me that you actually intended not to have it mean consecutive, right? So if you use it in one place, you're admitting that you can use it in every place. And so whether the parties thought about it, intended it, doesn't matter. When you're approaching a contract or when you're approaching a statute and you're trying to understand it as a whole, a rule of statutory construction is going to be that other use of consecutive here elsewhere in the statutes is going to cut against the party attempting to impute that meaning into a section that doesn't use the word consecutive, right? And so because of that, you know, the court noted that that also, by the way, is consistent with the structure and the purpose, right, of the statute. The court determined that that particular section imposed a requirement on the city that would be inappropriately limited if the benefit were limited to consecutive days in the manner asserted by the city in that particular instance. And so for that reason, and also for the statutory construction reason that we've already discussed, the court ruled in favor of the firefighter. The court also rejected, by the way, the city's argument that, a 24-hour shift meant two vacation days. So therefore that must count as 2 days under the statute. And the court's argument there was like, listen, the court didn't say, by the way, like, listen, but the court, you said the statute controls here. This is a statutory challenge. And while how something may be treated under a collective bargaining agreement could potentially be relevant for our consideration, it's certainly not determinative. And so in this particular case, the court refused to rewrite a statute to narrow a benefit, right? And the takeaway here is, you know, again, if we're trying to kind of catch and kill, if we're trying to identify a dispute, limit it, and maybe shrink it, which I think is what the employer tried to do here, we have a court saying that we're not going to allow you, in this particular case, City of Melrose, to shrink a statutory benefit by importing a contractual definition, you know, or an extra word that don't exist in the statute. You don't get to redefine it by statute if the legislature has already defined it in the statute itself. So what are we to make of all these cases? You know, like I told you at the outset, we've got four different cases from four different places about four different things. But when you take a step back, you know, they really all tell the same story. Four different states, four different rights, four different statutes, but the same move, right, by either the employer or by a labor board, and the same judicial response. So when a party tries to win by a technicality, whether that's by like narrowing definitions or by attempting to relabel conduct or avoiding the actual question, courts may very likely be unwilling to play that game. And in this instance here, we had four instances where courts refused to follow the shiny object that the employer wanted them to look at, and in fact looked at the dispute in its entirety and reached a result in each of the four cases that was sought by the plaintiff, you know, or the appellant, essentially the employee interest. And so, you know, for union representatives, the lesson is, I think, or one of the lessons is, you know, look, we need to be aware of, you know, procedure. We need to be aware of, you know, technical definitions and understandings of the statutes that we work under and certainly our contracts. But we don't just leave it at that. You know, it's okay to consider purpose. It's okay to consider the real world impact, right, of the outcome of a dispute. And if you make those arguments in the right way, as it looks like those arguments were advanced apparently in the right way in each of the four cases that we have here, you might wind up with the right outcome, or at least that's how it turned out for these parties this particular month. So that's the podcast. Hope some of that made sense to y'all. Thanks for listening. Seminar information, if you want it, it's at www.lrs.com/seminar. Again, if you're on TikTok, you can find us at rick.p67. Short stuff, no dancing, lots of fun. I hope you guys stay warm in the month of February, and I'll see you next month. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.